every day at Mass. And remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit.
Pressed in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
The world is changing.
Christians executed in a mass beheading.
A gunman opened fire on two young journalists.
Fairly alarmed here.
Celebrations erupted on the steps of the Supreme Court.
They succeeded in painting us as irrational bigots.
More people are exercising freedom from religion.
It's a tough time, but it's a great time to be Catholic in America.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Al, you are doing great work.
It's a wonderful afternoon program.
I love it.
Let us go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Who's coming with
me? Anyone? Anyone?
And here we go.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for joining me. We got a great hour in front of us. We're going to be attacking one of the biggest falsehoods in circulation regarding the early church. You may have heard it said before. In fact, I'd be surprised if you haven't heard it said by one group or another, or by one novelist or another, or by one friend or another. It's the idea of the so-called great apostasy. This is the idea that somehow after the death of the apostles or after the end of persecutions, it's unclear, it depends on who's telling the story, there was this great falling away of the faith. The simple truths of the gospel became obscured by worldliness and pagan idolatry and kicked off the dark ages of Catholicism and then required some complete reboot at some time in the future. Protestant Reformation is usually one of those moments. In Mormonism, it's the restoration of the priesthood under Joseph Smith. There are different places, depending on who's telling the story. Among Muslims, it's the coming of Muhammad. The idea of a great apostasy is one of the cornerstones of false church history against certain groups, especially Pentecostal groups and certain Baptist groups in American Protestantism, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, The Way International, Islam. You've got the most famous recent outburst of it was Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, which repeated this great apostasy story. The irony, what's completely crazy about this and ironic, is that it claims to be rooted in history, but there is no historical evidence for it. In other words, all the evidence is on the side of continuity. Yeah, all you have to do is look at the teaching of the New Testament, trace that through the letters of Ignatius of Antioch, Clement of Rome, go then to the era of the apologists, Justin Martyr and Irenaeus, keep going, and you can see straight continuity from the New Testament right on through to Constantine, into the Middle Ages, into the High Middle Ages. You see that same doctrine persisting through the Protestant Reformations, plural, always remember plural, and up to the present day. It was the apostasy that wasn't. And that's what's told by Rod Bennett in a book of that name. The apostasy that wasn't, the extraordinary story of the unbreakable early church. It's amazing how popular this story is. That alone would be worth some spilling some ink to find out how it became so popular. One reason it was popular is because for many years, the letters of Ignatius of Antioch had been lost. And so one of those connecting links between the New Testament and the early church had been lost. Rod will tell the story of Thomas Jefferson thinking that the earliest pieces of Christianity he could rely on were the writings of Justin Martyr. Well, not true. There are earlier writings like Ignatius of Antioch or Clement of Rome that overlay the later books of the New Testament. So these are stories that remain popular, not in academic circles, not in circles among serious lay historians, But this is a false narrative that remains popular within certain denominations and cultic groups, as well as in the imaginations of novelists like Dan Brown. Right now, however, let's go to today's headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you very much, Al. Welcome, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, November 9th. It is the Feast of Benignus, and today's news is brought to you in part by the St. Gregory Center for Drug and Alcohol Rehab at stgregoryctr.com. 2 weeks after the conclusion of the Synod of Bishops on the Family, Bishop Michael Campbell of Lancaster, England, has published an unofficial translation of the Synod's final document. The Synod's final report has three parts: the Church listens to the family in the design of God, and the mission of the family, and each part has four chapters. No official English translation of the Italian language document has been published. A change to marriage licenses in Kentucky is a clear victory for the county clerk who was previously refusing to issue them. That's what Kim Davis's lawyers at Florida's Liberty Council are saying after Kentucky Governor-elect Matt Bevin's announcement Friday that he will remove the names of county clerks from marriage licenses once he takes office next month. Liberty Council founder Matt Staver says Kim Davis applauds Bevin for his leadership in protecting Davis's right of conscience and her religious freedom. Pope Francis says the leaks of confidential documents will not stop his plans to reform the Vatican. The Pope said yesterday that leaking the documents is a deplorable act. He criticized two books published last week that look into the Pope's campaign to do something about financial mismanagement of the Catholic Church's finances. He called stealing the documents a crime and said it does not help clean up the financial mess. Pope Francis said the information that was leaked is based on a study he personally ordered. Two American contract workers are among the six killed in a shooting spree in Jordan today. A U.S. official says six others were wounded in the attack at a police training center near Amman. Jordanian officials say the gunman was a policeman and that he was killed by security forces. A South African and three Jordanians were also killed in the attack. The dead Americans were working for the State Department and training Palestinian security forces. And University of Missouri President Tim Wolf is stepping down.
I thought and prayed about this decision. It's the right thing to do.
Members of the student body, including dozens of Mizzou football players, had demanded his resignation for his handling of racial incidents on campus. Black members of the football team had said they planned to boycott team activities, including games, unless changes in university leadership were made. Wolf said resigning is the right thing to do, and his decision was motivated by his love of the university. And now your fascinating fact for the day. Hawaii's state fish. Okay, here we go. It's the humu humu nuku nuku apua'a. Wow. First time. For Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Shortly after I began following Christ as an adult, back in 1974, my wife's family came to me with a request to investigate a particular group that denied that Jesus was God in human flesh and who tried to say that the early church had fallen into a great apostasy. It was a group at that time, they were called the Way International. I'm not certain what they go by today. But the idea here was that after the death of the apostles, the church went into very steep decline. And what happens afterwards is hard to say. Usually what happens is it goes underground and pops up again around the Reformation era. But this particular group denied that the divinity of Christ, and so they didn't feel especially warm towards the magisterial reformers either. Jehovah's Witnesses have a similar narrative. Mormons have a similar narrative. The key to it is the great apostasy. For those of us who have spent any time at all trying to read from the New Testament through the apostolic fathers to the apologists, we don't see it. It's not there. It's a fallacious narrative. But the man who's done the best popular storytelling on this is Rod Bennett. Rod is a former editor of Wonder Magazine, a popular Christian media journal, and his writings have appeared in other national publications as well. Catholic Exchange, our Sunday visitor. Rod has been on the Journey Home with Marcus Grody. He's been on Bookmark with Doug Keck. His first book, Four Witnesses, The Early Church in Her Own Words, is an outstanding book published by Ignatius Press. I've had it for years. And Rod is a convert from the Southern Baptist faith, joined the Catholic Church in 1996. And he has written most recently, The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church. Rod, great to have you here. Thanks.
Good to be here, Al. I hadn't spoke with you in quite a while. It's good to reconnect.
I was just thinking the same thing. And by the way, I do love your writing. I don't think I've told you that before, but I had a fun time with this book.
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, I actually listened to it through Kindle, which is not the best way to listen to any book, but it's still very, very enjoyable. This must have taken you quite a while to tell this story, because you show a real personal familiarity with the fathers, with the dramatic details of the Arian controversy, Athanasius, the Christianizing of the Roman Empire, the fighting back of the pagans. Where does the idea of a great apostasy begin? Where do the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons, the Way International, certain Protestant groups, where do they come up with the idea that it's even plausible that there was a great falling away after the apostles?
Well, if you think about it, Al, if you find that the religious ideas that you're committed to, wherever you happen to get them from, whatever group you belong to or whatever, if you find that your denomination started 50 years ago, 100 years ago, sometimes if you're really lucky, 500 years ago.
Right.
But you find that there is a long period when Christians didn't teach that. In other words, the teachings of your church are hard to find any time before that. And that there was a long period during which people didn't say what your group says today. You've got to account for this somehow, and most people, like to believe that what they've been taught or are teaching comes from the Bible or from the apostles in the early days. Then just those facts alone are enough to create in your mind some sense that everything started out all right and went off the rails at some point. And then God had to sort of reboot the whole thing again by means of some modern reformer or prophet or some other figure.
Sure.
Fortunately, you get to pick which. And because there's an awful lot of different ones on the market.
Yeah.
The key insight for me that led me to start dealing with all of this was that even though it was easy for me as an evangelical Christian to dismiss some of the kookier versions of the idea, I found that even though I wouldn't have used the terms great apostasy, and I might have wanted to finesse it a bit and say that the church went underground or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, I realized one day that I essentially believed the same thing,
mm-hmm.
or did at the time, that that the early church was corrupted and turned aside so badly that that God had to have a fresh start at some point, and which I would have, of course, identified with the Protestant reformers of the 16th century, mm-hmm. although I'd read enough of their writings to be a little uncomfortable with them too. So it's just inherent in the idea that if you find that you're in a religious minority and that the great bulk of Christians in the world think differently than you do, then you've got to account for this somehow. And the great apostasy comes pretty quickly to mind.
Yeah. Now, when did Ignatius of Antioch's letters become commonly known? How early back, when did we begin to work those? Because in the 19th century, I know there was a recovery of some of them anyways.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's interesting you should bring that up. Thomas Jefferson, who is somebody that I really admire, one of his arguments, he was a disbeliever in the divinity of Christ.
Right.
He believed in some sort of apostasy theory, and that very early on in the history of the church, a false idea, a false deification of the prophet Jesus took place and led to modern Trinitarian ideas. He says in a famous passage, I think it's one of his letters to John Adams, he says that the first person to attribute divinity to Jesus was Justin Martyr. And the letters of the Apology of Justin Martyr and his writings, most of them date from around 150 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first read that, I went, well, that's wrong. That's completely off base,
right.
You know. But keep in mind, in Jefferson's day, it was taken pretty much for granted that the Gospel of John was written in the second or third century, and that these were very common ideas in his day.
Mm-hmm.
And those letters that you've mentioned of Ignatius of Antioch, in which, by the way, the divinity of Christ couldn't be any clearer than
right.
it is. At one point, he speaks about the blood of God shed
right,
on the cross.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to be any clearer than that.
Yep.
And they were written about 107 A.D., those letters. So, but those hadn't yet been rediscovered in the 18th century when Jefferson wrote. So, you know, I don't give Jefferson a free pass. There's things he should have known about. But but at the same time, it was a bit more plausible in those days than
right.
it is now.
I mean, because with the letters of Ignatius of Antioch, you've got pretty much an unbroken passing of the baton between the generation of the apostles and those who succeeded them and those who succeeded them.
Exactly right. Exactly right. They and again, those letters of Ignatius were very instrumental in my own conversion to the Catholic faith from evangelical Christianity.
Tell us a little bit about your upbringing and what eventually led you to see in the Catholic Church the fulfillment of what Jesus had promised.
Well, I had, for the most part, good experiences in evangelical Christianity. In fact, I wouldn't be here today, probably, if I hadn't been witnessed to by various interesting and spirit-filled characters through the years when I was still an evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely wouldn't say a word against any of them.
Sure.
But one thing that I had that was troublesome was I had a bit of a historical itch. I was a bookworm and was interested in history. And early on, I think, I was troubled a little bit by the fact that evangelical Christianity had what seemed to be a bit of a conspiracy theory for its history. And this idea that that nefarious people came along after the apostles left the earth and subverted and undermined the original faith and substituted some sort of changeling in the cradle. And that idea was troublesome to me. So that really set me up for an inquiry later on into the writings of these early fathers, which really was the beginning of the end for me as a Protestant.
Rod, hold it there. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Rod Bennett, my guest. The apostasy that wasn't. The extraordinary story of the unbreakable early church.
This Ave Maria radio program is brought to you in part by St. Gregory Retreat Centers, the new standard for recovery. St. Gregory Retreat Centers offers substance abuse treatment options using traditional Catholic teaching about virtue and access to daily Mass and reconciliation, combined with the latest evidence-based practices in substance abuse. More information is available at 888-778-5833 or online at stgregoryctr.com.
The mystery of death has troubled and fascinated humanity since the beginning of time. Our own experiences of mourning deceased family members and friends teach us the deep longing of the human heart for hope in the face of death. Many Catholics have lost a clear sense of how to face this experience with faith and peace. Planning funeral services in advance is not only a gift to our family and friends, but it is an affirmative way to embrace our own call to resurrection. Please take this time to call your local parish or diocese about pre-planning your cemetery and funeral rites. This message brought to you by Catholic Management Services.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by HomeschoolConnections.com, providing online, live, and recorded courses across the curriculum with a Catholic perspective. Subjects include science, math, philosophy, writing, history, literature, and much more. Adults and students in private and public schools can also take the recorded courses. HomeschoolConnections.com, educating the heart, mind, and soul in the Catholic tradition. Ave Maria Radio thanks HomeschoolConnections.com for their support.
Do not settle for a government-controlled and mandated healthcare system that forces you to choose between your healthcare and your faith. CMF Cure is a Catholic healthcare ministry that allows you to provide for you and your family's healthcare needs and to live your Catholic faith. Get the personal guidance from our ministry to make the right decision for you and your family. This is Lewis Brown, director of CMF Cure, and I invite you to check out CMF Cure today at cmfcuro.com. That is cmfcuro.com.
Republicans, Democrats, no matter which political party is in office, there are always investment opportunities to be found. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds won't compromise the moral beliefs of its investors. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. The portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and moral values. Call toll-free 866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month-end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
Charity Mobile is the only pro-life mobile phone corporation. LifeSite News recently featured Corporate Watchdog Second Vote and their research of corporations that fund Planned Parenthood. The article concluded that only 7 corporations are ranked as being pro-life, while 234 corporations have abortion-supporting scores. Charity Mobile is one of the 7 pro-life corporations and the only mobile phone company. 5% of your monthly talk plan price goes to the pro-life charity of your choice, and there are no contracts, no termination fees, and no risk with your 30-day trial. Call 877-474-3662 or go to CharityMobile.com today. Mention Ave Maria Radio and get a free 4G LTE smartphone plus free activation and free shipping. Life is calling. Take it with you. Call 877-474-3662 or go to CharityMobile.com today.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. My guest, Rod Bennett, is narrating the drama of the early church fight to preserve Christian orthodoxy, talking about his own encounter with these truths of history. So you had a historical itch as an evangelical, and that drove you to begin reading in the early church. When was the first time it dawned on you that there was this kind of unbroken continuity between the apostles and the generation that followed and the generation that followed them?
Well, it's interesting. You as an evangelical Christian, you often are presented with the idea that there's a kind of a dark continent of a blank space on the map in between the close of the New Testament
right.
and later history. Most evangelicalism has as its goal the idea of putting things back to the way they were in the early church.
Kind of primitivism, I think, is what people often call that.
Yeah, I think that's the technical term. The idea that it's implied by the idea that all of these barnacles attach themselves to the faith through the centuries, that you want to go back to the pristine early state and do things just the way they were done in Bible days.
Yeah.
So, very helpful to maintaining that idea, though, is the if you don't scratch around too closely in the historical records, because the minute that I discovered that there were such records, that there was no gap or blank spot on the map there, but that we have writings that have survived from people who knew the apostles, who were converted by Peter or John or something like that.
Yep.
And that there are thousands of pages. It's not skimpy. It's not a few lines in an archaeological museum. There are many hundreds and hundreds of pages of documentation about what the early church was like and what these second generation witnesses mm-hmm. Believed about the faith and how their church services were done and all sorts of other uncomfortable things. So if you go back and start looking at all of that, as I did, you encounter something else very awful from the Protestant perspective too, and that is that these writings are all full of stuff that isn't supposed to be there, that we believed arose in the Middle Ages or something.
Right.
You know, and that is high honors paid to the Virgin Mary, or the idea of baptismal regeneration, or confessions to a priest, or purgatory, or any of these other things.
The centrality of the Eucharist, for heaven's sake.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And very, very strong language about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist.
Yeah.
These things are all there in these early writings. And, of course, if you believed first that the writings didn't exist, and then when you began to examine them, that you find that they're full of things that aren't supposed to exist for another 1,000 years, then you've got a real problem on your hands as a Protestant, or at least a naive Protestant as I was, who had never heard of any of this, and it caused an earthquake.
How long did it take you, once having seen this historical problem, how long did it take you to eventually come into full communion?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that. My wife was a little quicker to come than I was.
Huh.
She was ready to go 5 years probably before I was.
Huh.
But I put up a bit more of a fight. I wriggled on the hook a little more. And we fooled around with various halfway houses, Anglicanism, mm-hmm. and some other things like that. And God bless all those people.
Sure.
No slight implied. But for us, that's what it was. At least in my case, that's what it was a sort of more or less conscious halfway house for somebody who was a little bit scared of the great beast sitting on the seven hills. You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. you do a wonderful job dealing with Constantine, one of these titanic figures in world history and certainly in church history. The corruption of the church under Constantine is a common theme in all of these stories of the great apostasy. The early church was the church of persecution. So you can, in some of these narratives, the church persists for a while after the death of the apostles, but it's persecuted, but it keeps its original purity and pristineness. But then all of a sudden, Constantine comes along and eventually makes the church, favors the church, and in doing so, he corrupts it. Ah, even worse, he calls a church council and imposes the divinity of Christ on the Christian church. Who was Constantine? What did he do? And why is that narrative so false?
Well, it's a very popular narrative because that period really does represent a watershed moment in the life of the church.
Mm-hmm.
When you essentially, I mean, the dark reading that's usually given to it is, as you spelled out there, that Constantine allowed himself to be converted in 313 A.D. He picked out his favorite version of Christianity and sponsored it to the exclusion of all others. And that he made that version of Christianity, the Catholic version, into the state religion of the Roman Empire. This brought in a vast flood of half-converted pagans who came in mainly to gain social advantages on the political scene. And these people brought in all sorts of souvenirs from their paganism, all things like statues in the churches and all the other things that are supposed to be the distinctives that are quasi-pagan, as we see in the Catholic Church these days. Well, the reason that people commonly go to this spot, again, if you're searching for a point in which things went off the rails, it's a convenient spot to look at, because this was really a change in the church's life.
Mm-hmm.
It was a watershed moment, in some ways a coming of age.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, a lot of that has been very misunderstood and overblown. For instance, the idea that the church of the first, second, third centuries was pure, this pure persecuted band of New Testament believers meeting in homes with no ritual, no officers, just this very loosey-goosey kind of association as we enjoyed as evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that this early church in these centuries was huddled in the catacombs until Constantine came along, and that changed everything, is simply historically false.
That's right.
The church hadn't been in the catacombs for many decades before the conversion of Constantine. In fact, during the second century A.D., that is the years one that begin with 100, and also the third century, even though there were sporadic persecutions, the church was growing enormously. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the 200s A.D., had become such a large, important minority in the Roman society that there were very big, Eusebius, the church historian, tells us that there were enormous golden church buildings that that were, if anything, envied by the emperors.
Yes.
And this is in the 200s A.D., 50 years or more before Constantine even became a Christian. Mm-hmm. So they were a recognized part of Roman society, and also they weren't very pure either.
Well,
in fact, not much more pure than any other era of Christianity.
Right. The
records show, well, the scholar Origen, who wrote about the year 250, tells us straight up that he thought the church was whoring in his era.
Yeah. Yeah.
He went down a long catalog of sins and things that were going on. And he pined for the days of the early church, which is funny because we think of Origen himself as the early church.
Right.
But he was pining for the days of the early church when the church was pure and New Testament believers, et cetera, et cetera.
You would think he never read 1 Corinthians then. So.
That's right. And that ultimately gives the lie to the whole myth that that a perfectly pure early church was put off the rails in the early 300s. Because the perfectly pure early church doesn't even appear in the pages of the New Testament itself.
Right. It doesn't exist there, right?
That's right. So, but it does, this idea does exist as a powerful motivation. In fact, in some ways, a good motivation. You know, we call it primitivism or whatever, but the desire to reform and conform mm-hmm. the church's practice to her belief
right.
is a good one.
It is.
It's one that we all ought to strive after and seek for.
Sure.
But if it becomes a kind of a morbid infantilism, in other words, a kind of a nostalgia for a golden age that never really was, then it can do harm, and it has done harm in this case.
Well, let me ask you, was Constantine an authentic Christian? If so, why did he wait to be baptized?
That's an interesting point, too. A lot of people have heard that Constantine was not baptized until his deathbed. And that is true. You know, the Eastern churches have actually canonized Constantine.
Yeah,
He's a saint in the East. Our church has been a little more circumspect on that point.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, our church has always had what up until recently was the common sense understanding of what Constantine's life was like. He didn't rise to the level of heroic sanctity, but he was a man who definitely was converted to Catholic Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
However imperfect he may have been as an individual Christian, there's funny accounts of Constantine's personal behavior. Eusebius, I think, tells us that he was so enthusiastic in his new convert zeal that he wandered around his own palace looking for people to preach to, and the servants got tired of it after a while and complained. So, but there's more concrete evidence, too. He immediately began to change laws, outlawed some of the more barbaric things that happened in the gladiatorial games,
mm-hmm.
Outlawed crucifixion as a form of capital punishment right away. Long list of reforms and changes that Constantine made almost from day one. Now, the question is sometimes raised. Before I lose the other thing you asked me, he was back. Yes, it's true that he wasn't baptized until his deathbed, but actually, this was a fairly minor, a common minor abuse in those days. There were such emphasis was placed on the catechumenate, and there were so many people who were catechumens. And during times of persecution, it had been made clear that if you had not yet been baptized, if your journey to baptism, which sometimes took 2 years or more in the quickest circumstances, if it was interrupted somehow during the course of your life by death, persecution, that you would go to heaven even without water baptism.
Okay.
That the catechumens were fully members of the church.
Was he afraid of post-baptismal sin?
That's the abuse part of it.
Yeah.
The desire arose to maybe remain a catechumen all your life.
Yeah. Hold it there, Rod. We'll come back, continue conversation, talking about the early church and the common false story that the early church fell away after the death of the apostles or was corrupted at the time of Constantine. There are other forms of it, too.
WeatherGuard has been protecting Michigan homes for nearly three decades. But what about the earth, our common home? With the latest innovations in windows and insulation, WeatherGuard is dedicated to products that last well beyond the low standards set by our throwaway culture and are carefully engineered to cut energy costs and reduce the impact we have on our common home. Visit WeatherGuard.com to get a free estimate and learn how you can do your part to reduce energy consumption. We're WeatherGuard, and we're here to protect your home.
Did you know that Ave Maria Town in Southwest Florida is really growing?
Tell me about it.
Ave Maria truly is one of the nation's fastest-growing master-planned new home communities.
Is that because there's no snow?
Well, the weather sure helps, but Ave Maria, Florida is a unique place.
How so?
The town of Ave Maria has been designed as a hometown for the 21st century, a place where residents of different generations and backgrounds can find all they need to live life to the fullest. School, shopping, employment opportunities, and more. In addition, the presence of Ave Maria University, a Catholic university that is both excellent and affordable.
Sounds great. What else?
Houses are being sold starting in the low 200s with several communities to choose from. There's a private Catholic K-12 school along with golf, bike trails, a fitness center, not to mention several daily masses and adoration within walking distance.
So how can I arrange a visit?
Call Carol at 239-249-2111. That's Carol Carpenter at Berkshire Hathaway, 239-249-2111.
Weingarts, everything.
Hi, it's Dan Weingart. Stay ahead of winter storms this year with one of our in-stock snowblowers. We carry top brands like Toro, Honda, and Cub Cadet, and offer expert service and parts for most brands. See our specials at Weingarts.com or visit our stores in Utica, Farmington Hills, Cedar Springs, Clarkston, and Ann Arbor.
Weingarts, Weingarts, everything from home to snow.
Have you lost a loved one? Do you have questions regarding estate settlement? How are my taxes, estate plan, and investment plan affected by the loss of a loved one? How will my Social Security be affected? And will I have enough income to maintain my standard of living? To answer these questions and for assistance in all estate settlement matters, contact the experts at Michigan Retirement Specialist, 313-2-RETIRE. Again, 313-2-RETIRE. Christians around the globe are being persecuted unlike ever before. In many cases, they are facing what the disciples faced, convert or die. Under Caesar's Sword is a joint effort of the University of Notre Dame and Georgetown University to look at how Christian communities around the world can respond to severe violations of religious freedom. An international conference is a major component of Under Caesar's Sword. It will take place in Rome on December 10th through the 12th and will introduce the results of the world's first global investigation into violations of religious freedom. The conference will feature speakers such as Paul Bonney from Pakistan, Marianne Glendon, Paul Marshall, George Weigel, and many more. Crest in the Afternoon has been invited to attend the broadcast from the conference, and we'd love to see you there. Under Caesar's Sword will take place at the Pontifical Urbaniana University in Rome on December 10th through the 12th. For more information, click on Under Caesar's Sword banner at AveMariaRadio.net. Now is a good time to begin thinking about Advent by making an intentional decision about how you'll prepare your heart for our new liturgical season. Our Lady of Grace bookstore has many wonderful Advent reflection books, calendars, wreaths, and candles to choose from. And while you're at the store, begin your Christmas shopping. We're chock full of meaningful, high quality, and special gifts for those you love. We're located in Ann Arbor at US 23 and M14 inside the Domino's Farms Office Park at Lobby C. Visit us at our ladyofgracebookstore.com or Facebook for hours and directions.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Rod Bennett. The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church, new book published by Catholic Answers, which I want to strongly recommend. I've enjoyed it immensely, and it's a much richer
narrative than you get in your normal church history books. You actually begin to feel you know the characters, like Athanasius and Constantine. Even Diocletian, you have some clever things to say about him, the persecutor. Did Constantine call the Council of Nicaea because he wanted to impose his form of Catholic Christianity?
No, but he did call the council. Mm-hmm. Impose is the wrong word. Mm-hmm. Constantine certainly did call the council, because the latest heresy that was troubling the Catholic Church in those days, the heresy of Arius, from which we get the term Arianism, not to be confused with the much later white supremacy theory,
right,
associated with Adolf Hitler, but there was a heresy abroad in those days that was disturbing the peace of the church. Constantine, it is absolutely true that Constantine adopted Christianity and sponsored Christianity in his empire, because he thought it was healthy for the empire and good for Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that he thought that it would be good is to have one sensible, revealed truth of religion that the people could rally around, and therefore to see dissension and trouble within the church itself was troubling to him, as of course it is to Christians.
Sure.
So Constantine called for a council, but it's interesting that Constantine didn't say how the matter was to be resolved. In other words, often you hear that he sponsored his favorite version. In reality, he simply called the bishops together and he said, parse this out. Figure out what the right answer is, because we need to settle it. And, of course, the church responded, not so much because Constantine called for it. They knew that the problem needed to be solved, too. But they also accepted the idea that the church, as St. Paul teaches, has a responsibility to obey the rulers, our secular rulers, even whenever you can.
Sure.
And this was a matter that that they agreed needed to be settled.
Were many of the bishops who arrived for the council themselves former victims of persecution?
Absolutely, yes. One of the richest things about that story, and one of the things that most gives the lie to the idea that Constantine put something over on the world here.
Right.
Is the idea that that these guys could be shaking in their boots in front of the emperor.
When they'd already endured the hot irons of persecution.
Absolutely. The worst of the Roman persecutions happened in the lives of this generation. And Eusebius the historian tells us that the bishops who met at Nicaea looked like an assembled army of martyrs.
Yeah.
There were eyes poked out, limbs torn off, all of the other things that had happened to these confessors during the last great persecution, that of Diocletian in 303. All of these things were still very apparent on the physical bodies of the delegates assembled. So the idea that the emperor dictated the results at Nicaea is ridiculous, because the emperors had been trying to dictate results for centuries, and the bishops had heroically resisted in spite of everything that torture and the rest of it could do.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that these guys suddenly just changed their minds and let the emperor rule the church comes from a not very clear idea of what the times were really like.
Why didn't the Council of Nicaea, doctrinally it settled the question of Christ's divinity or the Son's relationship to the Father, why didn't it sociologically settle it? Because there was still a lot of fighting over it. And, of course, the great story of Athanasius against the world follows the Council of Nicaea. So tell us, why was there still dissent?
I'd like to state your question just a little bit differently.
Please, go ahead.
The Council didn't settle the divinity of Christ. There had never been any question about the divinity
of
Christ
very
from
good.
Day one.
Very good.
The issue was, what was the relationship between the divine Son of God and the divine Father of the universe?
That's
the
right.
Son's Father. In other words, why don't we have two gods here?
That's right.
This was the question that Arius raised. Mm-hmm. Arius tried to solve the problem of the divinity of Christ in relationship to God's, the Father's divinity. He tried to resolve that problem with a faulty answer. And his faulty answer made the sought to save strict numerical oneness in God by means of a trick. In other words, Jesus is not really God in the same sense that his Father is God.
Right. Right.
But he's more like a sort of a Xerox copy of God that God made.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was attacked was not the divinity of Christ, but the eternal sonship of Christ, the idea that he'd been God from the beginning and wasn't a created being.
Right.
Anyway, we could talk about that deeply, but that's not really quite what we're doing here. You asked why the council, which was overwhelming.
Right.
One of the more absurd things in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code book, which, by the way, is another example of a very typical Protestant great apostasy theory.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Dan Brown gets more Protestant than even the Protestants, he protests the divinity of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But he's once again, he's enacting the old story of, well, the church started off all right but went off the rails. One of the most absurd things in that is Dan Brown claims that the divinity of Christ itself was settled at Nicaea by a relatively close vote, as he puts it.
Right, right.
which is, you wonder, not just which book was he getting this out of, but had he even bothered to look at a book?
Even checked it out.
Right, because...
Go ahead, you have the numbers there. There were at least
300 bishops at Nicaea, of which at the very outside there were about 22 who were willing to question not the divinity of Christ. Keep in mind, there was nobody at Nicaea teaching what Dan Brown believes, mm-hmm. that Jesus was just a wise man or a sage, a merely human prophet. That there was no humanitarian party at Nicaea.
Right.
The Arians loudly affirmed the divinity of Christ, but on their own terms, the way they defined it. But he definitely was a supernatural being in their eyes. They never denied the virgin birth, the resurrection, any of the other things like that. But the vote that came out at the end, at the very most, there were about 22 bishops. And many of the other accounts say many less than that. But at the end of the council, only two of the bishops held out for the system of Arius.
Only two?
Two okay. out of 312 or something like that.
Hmm.
So a tiny, tiny number of people were willing to rock the boat on this. So it was an overwhelming majority that voted in favor of the traditional Christian view that goes all the way back to Ignatius and Justin and the other earliest apostolic fathers, that Christ is fully God. And those who were willing even to question it was a very small minority at Nicaea.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't that then settle the matter for the entire empire?
Well, the reason is that when Christianity came to have such an important role in society as it did, especially when Constantine began to approve of it and point at it as the way to go for his empire. When that happened, there were forces in the empire who didn't trust the idea of giving the Catholic Church so much power.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In other words, they didn't like to see what they were seeing, and that is Constantine bowing, as he did bow, to the judgment of the Catholic bishops on one issue after another. I use a metaphor at one point in the book. I said that for the unbelievers in the empire, watching Constantine submit to the authority of the assembled fathers at Nicaea must have been like watching your father converted to some strange cult and then immediately start signing his property over to the chief gurus. And so there was resistance. There were people who were scared of what was going on, people who hadn't yet converted or hadn't fully converted, and they wanted a Christianity that was less large and in charge. In other words, they wanted a Christianity that could be used to unite people who had no intention of converting to an orthodox form of Christianity. So Arianism offered that opportunity. Mm-hmm. After all, Arianism, in a sense, since it denies that, that Christ is an eternal God, then it could put itself forward as a chance to continue worshiping a creature rather than the Creator, mm-hmm. as paganism had done since time immemorial.
Yeah.
In other words, Arianism can be interpreted in such a way that a pagan can look at Christ in the same way that a pagan looked at Apollo or Hercules or one of the other demigods of Roman mythology as a sort of a son of God, so to speak, a son of Zeus, and interpret the whole thing, still call himself a Christian, interpret the whole thing in pagan terms.
Mm-hmm.
So Arianism was sponsored in the age, not by Constantine, but in the age of Constantine, there were people sponsoring the Arian heresy and who continued to sponsor it for the next 100 years, who were doing it as a way to subvert the power of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Well, the pagans didn't take this laying down, apparently, right? They had violent outbursts against Christians.
You know, to tell you the truth, there's very little of that. Outright violence.
Mm-hmm.
Paganism was in a pretty moribund state at this point.
Okay.
This is proved, but you know, one of the great lies is that the only reason the Roman Empire started turning Christian was to please Constantine. Well, Constantine's second successor, who was the Emperor Julian, went back to paganism.
Right. Right, Julian the Apostate.
That's right. So if the people of the empire only converted to Christianity to please Constantine, then surely they would have converted back to the traditional religion of Rome to please Julian.
I thought there had been some riots of pagans.
You know, to tell you the truth, most of the rioting that happens in this age, now a little bit later in the time of Theodosius, there's actual suppression of paganism, the closing of temples and other things like that.
Okay.
That takes place after this story is over. This is Constantine had been dead for 40 years or so by that time. So yes, at that point there's pagan uprising and et cetera. But the people who are unhappy with what's going on channeled almost all of their effort into sponsorship of Arianism during the time we're actually talking about.
Rob, thank you so much. We'd love to give you a call again because these moments in history we like to remember, and we'd love to have you on as a storyteller in the future.
That sounds great. Well, anytime. Just give me a call.
All right. Rob Bennett, The Apostasy That Wasn't is the name of the book.
I'm Reno Fursita, founder of Smart Money Financial Advisors. A few months ago, I said that this year would look very different than the last year as far as the investment climate. And although things already have been pretty different, I believe this is the tip of the iceberg, that we're in the early stages of a major decline that'll be reminiscent of the last financial crisis. And the only difference is that this time, things may not come back as quickly as they did the last time. And my question to you is, are you going to take action to protect everything that you've worked for? Or are you just going to wing it and then hope and pray that everything comes back for you? You owe it to yourself to take advantage of the products and strategies that are readily available that are designed to grow your money in a safe and smart way. I help people every day do just that, and I'd be happy to work with you as well to do just the same. To speak with me directly, call 248-468-4401. That's 248-468-4401.
Advisory services offered through CoreCap Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
The Christ the King Worldview Series continues on Putting on the Mind of Christ with St. Louis University's Father David McConey.
Culture comes from a Latin word, colo, to worship. You can tell what people worship by looking at our culture. You can tell what we worship when teenagers are killed for $150 pairs of tennis shoes, right? You can tell what is of value to us today. And as Catholics, we have an easy answer to the word culture, because there's only one thing in this world we worship, the Blessed Sacrament, the Eucharist. Everything else we may honor, venerate, respect, but we worship only Jesus Christ. And the Eucharist is his way of continuing his presence with us.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Hear Father McConey's talk on the Eucharist from one of the earlier Christ the King Worldview sessions. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
It's amazing to watch how, how frequently false stories circulate about the history of the church, especially the early church. And part of it is because living in a largely Protestant culture, there's a popular sense that you've got the New Testament era, and then you kind of leapfrog over the so-called Dark Ages, Middle Ages, and then you land in the Reformation where there's this return to New Testament primitivism. Again, very false, but this is the way the story is often told. And then you've got a few hundred years where people are unclear exactly what's going on. But bang, then you get to the 20th century, and Americans have Billy Graham. That's the way a lot of people look at church history. Now, it's, of course, much more interesting than that and much more subtle than that. But what you don't have is a break with historic Christianity. There's conflict, but primarily continuity. And Rod does as good a job as anybody I know in telling that story. And he does it with a storyteller's touch. He doesn't just give you the footnotes and the history quotes. What I loved about it is the characterization of some of these central figures. Eusebius of Caesarea, for instance, comes across not quite the hero you might have thought he was. Constantine turns out to be, again, a titanic figure who had his own conflicts governing, but remained very faithful in terms of the affirmation of that Christ is Lord. You have Athanasius against the world. You have the rise of Julian the Apostate. It's a really worthwhile story, and one that I wish all Catholics were familiar with. It's a good book. The Apostasy That Wasn't, the extraordinary story of the unbreakable early church. Jehovah's Witnesses tell this false story. Mormons tell this false story. The Way International tells this false story. A number of Protestant denominations still tell this false story, usually the very kind of low church Pentecostal sorts. You also have fiction writers like Dan Brown telling this false story. So get a hold of it. It's called The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church. Rod Bennett, I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio. The federal government requires nearly all AM signals to reduce their power at sunset. But now you have choices. Download the Ave Maria app on your smartphone or listen live anywhere online at AveMariaRadio.net. You'll continue to hear Cresta in the Afternoon and other great Catholic programming from Ave Maria Radio.
WeatherGuard has been protecting Michigan homes for nearly three decades. But what about the earth, our common home? With the latest innovations in windows and insulation, WeatherGuard is dedicated to products that last well beyond the low standards set by our throwaway culture and are carefully engineered to cut energy costs and reduce the impact we have on our common home. Visit WeatherGuard.com to get a free estimate and learn how you can do your part to reduce energy consumption. We're WeatherGuard, and we're here to protect your home.
Are you the person others come to for advice? Are you the shoulder friends lean on when they're struggling? Along with its clinical programs offered on-site in the greater D.C. area, the Institute for the Psychological Sciences is now offering an online MS in psychology so that you're better equipped to help people to flourish. Could God be calling you to pursue a graduate-level psychology degree rooted in the Catholic understanding of the human person? Learn more at www.healourculture.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical. And in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria.